that it may have, looks like it may have failed, something has gone wrong with it, and the possibility is the instrument is the one that's at fault. So, basically, I will emphasize, have a way of checking your instrument, and that's why I basically outlined what to do with the Smith chart to make a Smith chart. When you do it, if you have a number of different ways to check your accuracy, such as going to somebody else's instrument and comparing it, or going to another instrument like I had outlined, measuring, for instance, resistive loss, and compare the RL to the RL reading you're getting on your antenna analyzer, because there is a very complicated relationship between VSWR, Z, R, and X. So I hope I clarified that for all the listeners. The VSWR is one part of it. Z, R, and X are the other parts of it. They all have a relationship to one another. That's about it, Dick. Over.
You got it. The Fannie wave ratio is sort of a simple reading, but it's made up of a number of components. You could call it the reflection coefficient and its phase angle. You could call it the real impedance of your antenna and resistance plus reactance. Or you could talk about the impedance of your antenna that appears to take place in the shack because of the length of your particular feed line, which has got both a phase delay to it and some insertion loss. And all of those can be related. Back in the old days when Mel and I cut our teeth in electronics, the way people operated an ohmmeter was you picked up your Simpson 260, your Triplett 630, or your Heathkit vacuum tube voltmeter, VA7. All three of those ohmmeters contained a 1.5-volt flashlight battery. That 1.5-volt flashlight battery is what operated in the ohms function, simply because in those days you couldn't go out and buy a 1.5-volt high-accuracy voltage regulator. It didn't exist. If you wanted a 150-volt regulator with tubes, yes, easy. But a 1.5-volt regulator, no way in hell. So they put a 1.5-volt flashlight battery, a D-cell battery, in each of those instruments. Therefore, before you did an ohmmeter measurement, the first thing you did is you shorted the two ohmmeters leads together, and you zeroed it out. In other words, you adjusted the left-hand knob until the meter read something close to zero ohms. Then you proceeded with your ohmmeter measurement. You were confirming that the battery was there, but the battery wasn't dead, that it was making good contact, and the rest of the instrument was operational. So that every traditional electronic enthusiast who comes from the era that Mel and I come from, way back in the dark ages, before we make an ohmmeter measurement today, even though we're using a modern-day digital voltmeter, the first thing we do is short the two leads together and better read a small fraction of one ohm, and then we proceed with the measurement. If it reads 15 ohms when you short the two leads together, you know something is wrong. You're not making good contact on the banana plug that plugs into the front panel, or you've got some broken leads inside the wiring, or whatever. So, everybody from the old school shorts the two leads together, better get a small fraction of an ohm reading before you proceed. We're doing a calibration. Even an ohmmeter measurement has a calibration procedure. Everything needs calibration if you want accuracy. And whatever you use to calibrate, you have to calibrate it periodically. You're about to start asking, where does it end? And that's a tough one. Hey, with any further comments?
Long wind. Repeater. Time out. 0 seconds.
Anybody with any further comments, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW on the TechNet.
K2KY.
You got it, Mel.
Okay, in fact, one of the questions I forgot that was basically what I did get an email is the reference to, you were talking about vertical antennas and radials, and I think that this is one really place that doing more than just measuring SWR, if you are going to add radials, or whatever, and you really want to know what the vertical is doing, you have got to measure a lot more than SWR. So this is basically where it started with the explanation of, as I said, VSWR, VR, and X, that if you want to know what adding a radial is doing, if you can basically want to do that simple Smith chart calculation like I outlined, it can help you quite a bit. And this is the simplest use of the Smith chart that I can think of, Dick, over.
It's a good beginning example. And I guess next week we'll have more examples. So you're going to have a series of lectures on the subject of Smith chart. When we get a chance, I'm going to get back and then go into the next step of transformers. We scratched the surface on transformers last week. And I got some replies from people saying, gee, I didn't know a transformer does that. I didn't know I could do that with it. Just wait till you find out what the primary inductance is doing to you, and what is the secondary inductance not doing to you, and why does the secondary inductance not count, and only the primary inductance counts, and what's the right amount of primary inductance versus the load of the transformer, and so on. And why can't I just put a six-sided copper box over my transformer and get rid of the magnetic field coming out of it? I just did a calculation today using Poser. Poser is a very good microwave textbook. It's in its third edition, P-O-S-E-R, microwave engineering or something like that. Let me drop. And it turns out at 60 cycles, the depth of penetration, which means how far do you have to go down into the copper where the magnetic field is 37% of what it is before the copper. The answer for that, 37% depth in perfect copper at 60 cycles of a magnetic field, the answer is 1/3 of an inch, 334,000, I think it is. If you want the magnetic field to be shielded to 1/10 of what it was, you need a solid chunk of copper 3/4 of an inch thick, 2.3 skin depths are required. That's on the assumption that all six sides are made out of 3/4-inch copper, and it's all perfectly copper welded, not even the resistance of the solder you use on the corners. You can see why essentially nobody shields a magnetic transformer with copper, why they use mu metal. The copper, the depth of penetration of an RF signal at 10 gigs in copper happens to be 26 millionths of an inch. But when you get down to 60 cycles, it's a 1 over square root of frequency phenomenon. The skin depth, one skin depth of copper at 60 cycles is 1/3 of an inch in perfect copper. To me, that's a mind blower, opposite of common sense. When we get back to discussing transformers, these are some of the things we'll be discussing. I think we've gone through enough for one night to let these guys rest on all this jazz. And so I'm going to say 73. Mel, back to you for any final comments. KQLIW and the Tech Net.
WB2HWW, would a comment before you leave, Nick?
Okay, let Mel make his final comments, then we'll come back to Howie. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, I'll make it brief and just say that, yes, we'll try to continue and give a little bit more insight into this somewhat complex hobby and work that we do. In fact, one person asked me while I was also doing some instructing that if you took two 6.3 transformers and you connect the two 6.3 points together, you're making an isolation transformer. I says, yes. Well, why, if you put reverse one pair of the leads, do you get, instead of an isolation transformer, almost nothing on the other side? How come if you can't just reverse the 110-volt line and take care of it? Why is it going to be the winding on the secondary that has to be inverted in this case? So we can cover that and give the complex answer to what is actually happening in a case like that, Dick. Anyhow, we'll leave it for tonight. Thank you all for joining us on behalf of myself, K2K Y, and keep up the great emails, and I'll try to answer as many as possible. And I thank you for the support. All right, back to you, Dick, for any final comments. I can pick up Howie.
You are a devil for punishment. Did you hear what Mel's doing? He's offering to answer all of these technical questions in writing. I specifically tell people I am not promising that. I offer no promise that by writing you'll get an answer from me. You speak to me verbally because I can talk 150 words a minute when I get excited. I can give you an answer, and I can find out whether or not you're able to absorb it and how I should modify the answer. This all came about because when I wrote some articles way back in the dark ages of 1970 or so, I was getting 300 letters a year from guys who wanted all kinds of questions. And one particular man wrote me 14 consecutive letters in a six-week period, where each letter consisted of two pages full of questions and spaces in between. And on the 14th letter, I suddenly realized I can't live this life with this man who lived in Snug Harbor, Maryland. A really, really nice guy, but there's a limit. And so I make no promises that I'll answer emails. Mel is making that promise, and more power to him if he can keep doing it. Let's see what Howie's going to say. You got it, Howie.
Dick, you've been talking about measuring SWR. Do you know there are cables that people can use with their piece of equipment that will not cause any phase angle when you bend it? Pretty expensive cable.
Yeah, Gore-Tex and Yellow Wire, Fire Wire, something like that. But Gore-Tex is one of the companies. There's also another company, having trouble thinking of their name now, in California, that make very precision armored cables for measurements to be used with network analyzers. What Howie is referring to is that if you're trying to make a really exact measurement and you've used an extremely expensive calibration set and you think you've calibrated your cables and now you're about to connect your cables to the device on the test, in the process of going from your calibration procedure over to the device on the test, you may have to reroute the cable and bend it. And if you just got any old ratty cable that's laying on the floor and you pick it up and you do that, when you bend the cable takes on a brand new electrical length. Even after you straighten it back, it may not come back to the same spot. And there are companies, Gore-Tex is one of them, who will make you a precision set of very expensive cables that when you bend them, very little phase shift occurs. And when you straighten them back out, what little bit of phase shift you got will repeat. And the even more expensive ones, you can go to hot, cold, high humidity, low humidity, bend, unbend, and do all kinds of things, and essentially nothing changes to the phase length and insertion loss and impedance match of those cables. So if you're willing to pay for it, you can pay thousands of dollars for nothing but a piece of cable with a SMA or a precision SMA 3-millimeter connector on each end. Back to you, Howie.
W2VL repeater.
That's correct. But as far as the MFJ, I've used the MFJ, and I find them pretty accurate. For $300, you really can't go wrong with the MFJ, with the 269 or whatever it is, the one that goes up to UHF. Now, all you really need is a position load, an open or short, and, a 50-ohm position load. And if you check that, you're usually pretty accurate. So, for your money, you're not spending thousands of dollars like on a SiteMaster or using a position, like an IFR 1500 or 1200 and using a return bridge, a return loss bridge. You can get a lot of information out of one of these little $300 unit sticks.
I believe it. The whole philosophy of ham radio is that if you're crafty enough, you can use soda straws, straight pins, paper clips, postage measuring scale, a voltmeter, very simple instruments. And if you're smart enough, you can make some very high precision measurements. That's the craftiness of ham radio. the brute force approach is to write a check, buy a $10,000 instrument, and make your measurement. Well, if that's a measurement you only have to make three times per year, it may not be justified to go out and spend the big money for the fancy instrument. And your simple ham radio techniques, chewing gum and straight pins and soda straws and whatever, there are times when you can make some very good measurements, and the accuracy can be confirmed, and the inaccuracy, a good deal of it can be cranked back out of the measurement, so to speak. It's a matter of craftiness. That's what ham radio is all about. You want a practical technician, a practical engineer, you want an antenna engineer, you want somebody who understands RF, you will hire a ham radio operator. 90% of the time, that's the only way you're going to get that skill. That's an opinion. But it's an opinion based on 30 years of experience. Okay, you guys have had enough for one night. 73, you all. Try to be kind to each other. Mel and I will be back next week, and we'll delve a little bit deeper into all this jazz. We're going to find some of the mysteries that Mother Nature has set out for us. We're going to discover a few more of them. That's going to make you happier. It's going to make you richer. And the women are going to beat it past your doorstep once you've got this knowledge. Once we find out you've got this knowledge, look what we got to look forward to. Bye-bye, you all. KQRIW, Technet, Landmark, we're clear.
Are you going to give a degree in this? Are we going to get degrees?
You got it. It's going to be called the Casanova degree.
All right, no problem. I thought maybe you're going to start your own university. Hi, sorry. Great.